I think I will always be a little bit of a proof of work maximalist. But at the end of the day, they're both kind of forms of proof of work. The only difference is proof of work is about physical infrastructure. You know, you're committing, you're locking up stake in proof of work. Most people don't realize it. It's just that the stake is physical infrastructure. It's your ASICs and your data centers. That is your stake in the network. That's your capital that you're committing.
Hi, I'm Stephen McClurg here with CJ Wilson, and you're listening to the Bitcoin Bottom Line. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bitcoin Bottom Line with myself and CJ Wilson, your co-host. And today we have Christy Lee Minahan, one of the world's experts in mining.
Thank you guys for having me.
I feel a little underdressed right now already, but you know, I guess when we're up with the experts, you know, that's I should be better prepared for that.
Right. Well, it's like going to a law firm, right? You know, the lawyer wears a suit, you trust him. The miner wears a suit, you trust her, right?
I think I technically need a mining hat for you to actually trust my credentials, but I don't have one of those handy right now.
Yeah. As long as it has a little light on it.
It does, in fact. I actually do have a mining helmet with a little light. You know, you've got to accessorize.
and the fact that you say that birds aren't real, you know, there's no canary for the coal mine for you either, right?
No, there is not. There is not.
Well, let's get into it. I think the thought on everybody's mind right now is, what's happening with the price of Bitcoin? We hit all-time highs earlier this year, and then we've dropped about 50%. And at the same time, you have China putting curtailments on mining. You've got a lot of miners leaving China, going to other places like Texas or other places in the United States and North America. How does the miners moving from one country to another, low hash rates, What does that really have to do with pricing, and what are the miners doing with their Bitcoin right now?
Yeah, I mean, we can only speculate. I mean, unless you actually ask miners, but most of them have sadly been having to either suspend all of their operations or pay insane amounts of money to ship over most of the equipment over to either the EU or to the US. So miners are just doing a complete migration from China if they're lucky to get out. Folks might have seen on Twitter or through social media that there's actually some farms being destroyed to make an example of specific miners who haven't complied with the government shutdown requests. So there's millions of dollars of equipment just being steamrolled right in front of the farm owners. You know, prices naturally getting suppressed because of a few things. One is that folks are always panic selling. There's always slight panic selling in crypto. The second is that miners are having to quickly liquidate and, you know, get this equipment out as soon as possible, get it over into the US. They can start back operations back up. The third is that deploying these miners overseas in, you know, a US facility or an EU facility usually requires a pretty expensive down payment. So you don't do a month-to-month contract. You'll often do 3 months payment in advance based upon your projected energy usage. And then the other thing is that some miners, the larger ones, like you've got your Bitdeers or your larger mining pools or corporations, are coming over to the US and spinning up entirely new operations, which means there's capital expenditure to buy the data center, capital expenditure to buy all of the equipment, and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of panic with the Chinese crackdown coming around. There's natural price suppression because we are in the middle of the year. And then there is quite a lot of liquidity going on in Bitcoin just because miners are having to pay some expenses and get stuff shipped around.
So, Christy Lee, one thing that I'm always curious about is on this sort of rehashing as the hash rate bottoms when all these miners come offline. depending on where you put the miners in the new operation, you've got to deal with a new municipality, which might have regulations and stuff to comply with, right? You might have to get permits to put in new big amp panels to funnel the electricity to your operation. So how complex is that outside of America? Because obviously in America, it's fairly complex. You got to get a lot of permissions in order just to spin things up. There's not a lot of rack space available, right? So these people have to build new racks and really rebuild the whole infrastructure. So can you take us through that a little bit in terms of the mechanics?
Yeah, there's not too much different in terms of regulation and getting, some new transformers put up between China or between the US. You still have to deal with your utility company to get that done, get that infrastructure built out. So only a handful of the larger mining operations will do that, because there is about anywhere from 14-month lead time all the way up to 20-month lead time to actually get a facility up and running. It's not as simple as just, hey, I found a plot of land, I am just going to put my flag on the ground and get running. It's all dependent on what infrastructure is already there in terms of power and what can be utilized. So most miners won't be bringing over low voltage transformers or medium voltage transformers, which is what you really need to convert that high voltage transformer into useful electricity. If miners are going over into natural gas, a lot of them can just buy pre-built containers and kind of just plug and play. So there are those options available, but you don't have as much density as you would with hydro or coal. So I wouldn't say there's too much difference in the regulation per se. There's still paperwork that has to be filled out. They're still working with the utility companies. There unfortunately isn't a lot of capacity. This crackdown took everyone by surprise. Rarely do operators build out in advance. There's, like I said, there's lots of capital expenditure. So an operator, like a data center provider, doesn't want to go and build out space that will just sit idle. So we've also got miners that are just filling up Antminer containers, ant boxes, they call them. So they're a specialized little shipping container that Bitmain makes, and filling them up with miners and just shipping them off, ready to deploy anywhere where there's power. And that's also a bit of a solution. But again, you have the density problem where you're not getting as much density. And why that matters for miners is we're always about, cost optimization. We want to make sure that there's not a single inch of the space that we're occupying wasted, that, everything, every utility that we're using, every resource is going directly into Bitcoin mining, and it's not, inherently wasted in any way. Not too much difference between setting up a traditional data center, I would say, as well, in both regions.
So it really comes down to that blend between capital expenditure, speed of actual resources moving from place to place, right? Because like you said, it's a big operation. If you have a 10,000 square foot facility or a 20,000 square foot facility or more, then it's not like you can just, email that and have it pop up somewhere. The thing that I'm always curious about is, do those individual operators sort of liquidate their stock and then buy new stock somewhere else, so that way they can sort of make it more portable? Because it seems to me, like from asking around, that there's a lot of people that are willing to buy used equipment in order to try to, like you said, optimize whatever rack space they have to kind of fill that in, right? So it's like at some point the mining operator has to decide, okay, do I liquidate my Bitcoin? Do I liquidate my mining equipment, or, whatever sort of connectivity stuff that I have, and try to repurpose that and then start all over again? And then what's the speed it likes from starting over again versus trying to transport that whole thing and come up the cost that way? Because that's really the big, I think, decision that these guys have, right?
Yeah, you've actually hit the nail on one of the big problems we have, which is we've got too much equipment in the secondhand market right now. So for the miners who are not able to come over to the US, they either don't want to ship their equipment, they're not able to for whatever reason, or they just want to get out of Bitcoin because of this event, you know, they're liquidating off their equipment. The over in the US, we don't have as large of an appetite to buy overseas equipment as we would stuff that's already grounded and landed in the US with taxes paid that we can just immediately deploy. But miners are definitely liquidating if they're not going to move over. You don't have always the luxury to just go out and buy secondhand equipment or even buy new equipment when you're moving over. So there's a shortage right now on, you know, new ready-to-go units from the manufacturers. The manufacturers have been sort of caught up in this chaos and restrictions and drama. So there's already a supply constraint on new ASICs. You can't go and get any more. So all you're left with is the secondhand market. And that is predominantly just going to be the Chinese miners liquidating what they can. The second thing is, if you look right now on any of the Chinese marketplaces, you know, our eBay equivalents, there is just a ton of old electrical equipment and networking equipment at liquidation prices. But not a lot of that is really worth the cost of exporting over to, you know, to the US or to the EU. So it's just being liquidated in China at bargain prices. So what that influx of equipment on the secondhand market means is that there is going to be a lot of difficulty in selling new ASICs, which is, we've actually seen Bitmain cancel any more pre-orders or hash futures on their ASICs, on their new next generation of ASICs, because they're aware and, you know, they're predicting that there's just going to be way too much secondhand equipment in the market. If any folks listening remember the 2018 and 2019 days, it was also very similar, where we had just an influx of secondhand mining equipment flooding the market, and it made it really difficult to sell out new ASICs at a competitive price. I mean, why would you go out and buy a brand new machine when you can go pick up an S9 for $30 to $40 and still make a profit?
Well, let's talk about the supply chain issues with new miners for a moment. Is it because a lot of these are being manufactured in China and you just can't get them out of China? Is it because of the chip shortage in the US? And when do you expect that to turn around? Are you hearing any rumors of manufacturing starting to pick up in the near future?
Yeah. So the problem with our supply chain is it's really, really fragile. So during COVID, we had basically a 1.5 to 2 month stop of everything. And some places were 3 to 4 months, some places even 6 months. It is amazing how that little bit of interruption in our supply chain has absolutely tanked the efficiency of that market. So that caused us to be, you know, completely constrained on silicon, which ASIC manufacturers aren't just competing with, you know, average users of silicon, like the GPU market and the mobile phone market. They're competing with every single bit of equipment that you probably have in your house. Anything that you have around you probably has some sort of embedded ASIC, FPGAs, etc., all using the same silicon. So there is a lot of demand there, and, you know, we've been impacted by COVID. We're still playing catch up. It's getting a little easier depending on what process node you're targeting. So generally the altcoin ASICs do not have the supply constraints that a lot of the Bitcoin ASICs do. The other thing is that TSMC, GlobalFoundries, and Samsung, these are your silicon manufacturers and your foundries. They don't want to sell out a lot of their supply exclusively to the crypto community. You know, they have other customers to fulfill. They have other demands to fill. So they actually curtail how much is going back into the crypto market. So we've got so much demand up here because of the bull market we were in. Crypto miners just want to buy, but the supply chain manufacturers have to have pretty steady, continuous orders for them to continue to run a profitable business. No one wants to go chasing after the big crypto boom that always happens, and then there's just a giant crash when the next bear market hits.
So is it easier just to raise the price to throttle the demand on the from the manufacturer standpoint? Like an S19 at one point was like $15,000 or $20,000 on the market, right? Because there was no supply. So people that had them were able to like command. Because most people aren't, you know, most real mining operations aren't buying two of these things at a time. They're buying, you know, 100 to 5,000 miners, you know, at a go, right? That's their deposit level.
Yeah. So the reason the manufacturers press them like that is ASICs are kind of unique in that they're normally when you buy hardware, it's priced at your cost of production plus your NRE. So your, you know, what you've actually invested in, your royalties, your fees, people's salaries, all baked into the cost. So your TCO for the actual piece of equipment plus some profit margin. Hardware, it normally sits around 20 to 30% profit for companies like, you know, an Intel or NVIDIA, but it might sit closer to 10% for, say, a GPU manufacturer like ASUS. Crypto ASIC manufacturers like Bitmain, instead, they don't have that model. They sell out and price equipment based upon its time to ROI. So, and you know, an S19 in a bull market is going to be a lot more profitable than an S19 in a bear market. They're going to price it so that it's always, you know, usually continuous within anywhere from a 16 to 18 month payback period. You know, they make more money when times are really good and customers will continue to buy because, you know, there's so much demand and it's a profitable time. So that's kind of why they have that pricing dynamic in place.
But there's also a lead time issue as well, right? So if you have to, you put a deposit down on with Bitmain and then you don't get your ASIC for 6 to 9 months. So you're going to miss some of that bull market theoretically, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the gambit that the miner has to individually take.
That's why you have to prepare in advance. Running a mining operation, it's all capacity planning. It's not like you can just wake up and suddenly decide to get into it one day and just buy ASICs on a whim. So you have to do very careful demand and capacity planning. Miners go through an incredible amount of financial modeling and, you know, forecast predictions and, you know, their own internal predictions as well, just based upon sometimes instinct to figure out, okay, here is when we're going to see a hash rate spike based upon, say, the last 5 years of previous data. Here's where we might see hash rate drops, and then they will get their orders in advance. Operations, kind of like your Argo, your Winstone, or your Core Scientific, are going to be on a continuous buy schedule, which manufacturers also love, meaning that, you know, they're going to buy 10,000 ASICs every 3 months or so on, and they'll just have a continuous steady stream coming in, irregardless of the profitability. So you have a subgroup of miners that are just, I wouldn't say profit chasers, but they definitely do deploy when they're, you know, they get excited and deploy more miners when times are good. And then you have your more traditional steady producers of Bitcoin that are always just deploying and mining, deploying and mining, which is honestly it's very interesting to see the customer dynamics between the US and China, because China tends to be the kind of customers that will, you know, buy when times are really profitable. Whereas a lot of the US public companies just have a very steady buy schedule that they conform to.
Yeah. And we've just seen Bitcoin mining difficulty adjust now twice in the last couple of months. Do you expect to see more adjustments down? Or do you expect to see them go back up again now that it seems like hash rates have bottomed out and starting to pick up again?
Yeah, I think on difficulty, we will only see a very, very minor adjustment, which is normal fluctuation, maybe 2 to 3%. I think we're in a pretty good spot. Most of the farms that have been impacted in China, you know, have either shut down or that equipment is disconnected. What would be troubling and what could impact the difficulty is if another country decides to follow suit. Doubt it will happen, but still, that would make a pretty big impact. I don't expect that hash rate to go up astronomically for at least another 2 to 3 months. So it's going to take time for all of that equipment to get shipped and landed in the US and for it to start hashing again. And there's also a percentage of that equipment that just will not make it over to the US. That is, you know, it's completely destroyed or written off. So we also have to account for that. Based upon, you know, my estimates and the folks that I've been talking to, it's roughly going to be about 7 to 9% of the hash total network hash rate, which is a sizable amount of hardware that is getting wasted if you think about it.
Well, yeah, and it's not like you can repurpose those to do something else. They're, when they come offline, that's it, right? They're permanently offline.
Yeah, they can just mine Bitcoin. That's right. That's all they're.
That's it. It's just one shovel. So, I guess can you take us through a little bit about why miners hold through certain dips and sell through other dips? Maybe because I think miners are seen as this liquidity provider for people that are sort of new to Bitcoin, and they think that miners are instantly selling all of the Bitcoin that they get. But I think it's a lot more sophisticated than that, obviously, because the miners are going to try to take the biggest advantage, right? Because they're the ones that get squeezed the hardest with equipment. So they're also going to try to take advantage of the market when it benefits them the most and they have liquidity, right? So can you take us through the decision-making process on that?
Yeah. So there's actually a fantastic set of articles that I recommend anyone reads from Leo Zhang of Acacia Research, who wrote The Alchemy of Hash Power. And it actually goes deep into miner behavior and their buy and sell mechanics. But in general, mining is a business. You know, it is not something that you just get into and you respond to market whims. It is a business. You're deploying this CapEx and this OpEx that is often in lockup for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. And so it requires commitments. Your power contracts require commitments. Your relationships with the ASIC manufacturer, how you're getting the hardware, that is a social commitment. That's a social contract. You know, you're agreeing to be a customer. They're expecting you to be a customer long-term. Otherwise, they wouldn't give you, you know, as much supply as they would one of their longer-term customers. Even things like getting your transformers built out, these are still long lead times. Leasing out the physical space, leasing out the land, that's another commitment. So there are commitments every step of the way. Miners each have their own investment strategies. The public miners, buy and sell strategies are much more visible to us. Most of them are trying their very best not to sell any Bitcoin. They are firm believers in the asset. They understand, you know, its purpose, its value, they're holding. Rarely will you see miners, there used to be this perception that miners would take a big chunk of their Bitcoin that they've mined during the month and carve off 40 to 50% of it, every month to go and sell and pay for electricity. That's a pretty rudimentary model. Most miners will have some sort of, piggy bank or rainy day fund that they'll dip into to pay for their utilities and pay for all of their OPEX and any additional repairs. Rarely will they immediately start converting their mined cash. That wasn't always the case. Some public companies in 2018 had pretty steady sell schedules. You know, they'd immediately convert into cash at the end of week after mining Bitcoin because they didn't want Bitcoin on their balance sheet. I think that attitude has completely changed, at least in the US in 2021. So, most miners will only do very large liquidations if they're going to make a capital purchase in hardware or in a data center. In the case of hardware, all of the manufacturers will just accept the coin, so you don't need to go and exit out into USDT or into any other kind of fiat currency. For data centers, however, for utility providers, for anything else in the real world, you'll have to go and exit into the USDT. So if you look at the markets, you're able to often, maybe once every 4 to 5 months catch one of the larger miners on the market converting or liquidating some of that to go and, you know, pay pre-commitments to secure a space. So yeah, definitely recommend going out, checking Alchemy of Hash Power if you have any questions about kind of miner or buying behavior, but it's all very much just like a traditional business.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard about Bitcoin mining as a sort of, you know, large operation, it was basically, hey, this is like a cash waterfall. You just keep selling and then you keep accumulating dollars. But I think like that's when Bitcoin was down in the, you know, $3,000 range or something like that. Now that it's obviously 10 times that and people have eyes on the price going to, you know, six figures and beyond in the long term, like you said, there's this sort of the savings account, the Bitcoin piggy bank that companies want to have as part of their treasury. You know, and so you would especially expect a mining company, whether it's, you know, one of the publics or just a small operation to be doing it with the goal in mind of one day we will have X amount of Bitcoin under control and we won't have to sell it. Right. So that's the thought process there. I guess with the grid, specifically, how much of the miners are like trying to prepay, when they can, and to take advantage of the fluctuations, or is it just like a steady bill that they're getting from that local, you know, grid provider? I mean, I really like the idea of the off-grid mining, because then it's sort of, you're removing one layer, you're producing your own energy, so you can, mm-hmm. you know, so you can mine as much as you want, and you're not beholden to anybody coming to try to shut you off, which is sort of like, you know, in the ethos of Bitcoin to say like, hey, I'm going to do my own thing and be self-sovereign. But on a percentage basis, it seems like there's still a lot of operations that are actually on the grid, and I think that's where people have the most confusion, right? Because people come up to me, or maybe Steven, and obviously for you, I'm sure as well. Once people find out you're in this, they're like, "Hey, so can I just plug one of these things in at home?" And it's like, well, I mean, in California, I pay like 38 cents a kilowatt for residential if I don't have solar, right? So that's not a very good ROI on any kind of mining, you know?
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because there actually is a pretty dedicated fan base of what we would call home miners, folks that are mining at home and making a profit. But not just that, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, you have a whole suite of miners who have started to use ASICs to heat their homes. So instead of, you know, using a space heater to warm up a room, they're just using ASICs. And if you think about it, your space heater is already consuming, you know, the equivalent energy of an S9. And you're not exactly getting paid for that. You're not getting anything in return for the heat it's generating. So why not just use an ASIC instead? Yes, there's the noise, but, you know, you can always go and fix that and address that by soundproofing the little device, throwing lots and lots of soundproof foam around it. But that has been one of the trends we've seen, and there's been a lot of innovation. There's also the SHA Spa, which is from Jesse Pelton. It's a hot tub that is heated up and powered by Bitcoin miners. So I think that's incredibly innovative. And there's even some architecture firms around in the U.S. that will specialize in retrofitting some of your heating inside your home, where ASIC miners will just heat the house. So we're seeing that, not in Bitcoin mining specifically, but definitely in the altcoin mining space for altcoin ASICs. All of these are designed to be plugged into your home and allow people, you know, to mine at home. And then there's a subset of services that have sprung up, like Compass Mining, where you don't even have to, you know, go out, buy the equipment and operate it yourself. It's not quite cloud mining, because you own the hardware and you own the, you own the data center contract, and you can sell your equipment at any time. But it's, you know, it's definitely like, you know, a form of cloud computing. You buy your device, let it run, and you don't have to deal with any of the setup or expenditure. And we're starting to see a new class of miners coming in quite big swathes. You know, your more traditional, smaller retail miners almost, or, you know, hobbyist miners that are coming in. So I would say that, you know, there's still a demand. Even MicroBT has a line of ASICs dedicated to home mining. In the US, yes, you definitely are going to have to jump through some hoops to plug this into a traditional socket in your home. But definitely wouldn't rule it out. For, you know, for everything else, yes, there is a bit of confusion about how do you get involved and get started. Bitcoin mining used to, you know, 2013, predominantly the way you got started without having hardware or having the knowledge yourself was through cloud mining. Cloud mining really kind of died off in 2018. I would say it's got a pretty bad connotation and association with it. So now people that are getting really curious or interested in getting started are looking for alternate forms of, you know, how can we, you know, start mining today, start getting exposure to this. And they're then trickling in through either funds to get exposure to Bitcoin. If they want to still have the experience of mining, they're going into platforms like Compass.
Yeah, doing a little bit of research on Compass, it's pretty interesting because, you know, they give you a chance to buy the miner, right, and select the kind of what level you want to get it at, and also like what little zone or factory you want to have it at. And they're like, hey, if you want to have it in Ohio or Kentucky or, you know, whatever, these are the electricity rates you pay. And I think if a lot of people will come to me and they'll ask me, hey, I want to do mining because I think that's a good thing, but I've only got 15 grand or 20 grand. And it's like, okay, well then you're not obviously setting up a hash hut with, you know, upstream data or something like that and getting like a big or one of those digital shovels and plugging in hundreds of ASICs. That's just not, you're not on the budget for that. But the mining pool aspect of things, right, and getting people to pool together their hash power, I think really is interesting because it shows how flexible the network really is, right, and how it, like if you have enough people that are participating on a small level, that really does decentralize the whole network, which is sort of the goal, right, of all this, is that we can all pull a little bit on the string and tighten that network up across the world.
Correct. Yep. The point of decentralization, you've got two things you want to achieve. You want to achieve you want to achieve hash rate decentralization. So you don't want concentration in any one country or any one state. That is bad. You know, as we have seen from the China antics. And then you also have user decentralization. It is not good if there's only three people that a majority of that hash rate belongs to. So you want to get a nice mix between companies and corporations mining Bitcoin and individuals hashing and contributing to the network.
Well, to settle one of the biggest debates is proof of stake or proof of work. What do you prefer and why?
I think I will always be a little bit of a proof of work maximalist. But at the end of the day, they're both kind of forms of proof of work. The only difference is proof of work is about physical infrastructure. You know, you're committing, you're locking up stake in proof of work. Most people don't realize it. It's just that the stake is physical infrastructure. It's your ASICs and your data centers. That is your stake in the network. That's your capital that you're committing. And if anything happens to that equipment, you know, say you get a virus on your miners, the advantage of proof of work is you don't immediately lose that investment. You know, your physical stuff remains in the physical world. So you can go clean up your miners and redeploy them. If we look at proof of stake, it's not necessarily worse or better. It's just different. Proof of stake has different incentives and different mechanisms. You know, it's not designed to issue coins steadily. It's designed to lock up capital in the network long-term for liquidity providers and, you know, ensure that capital does not leave or exit the network. It's also got completely different attack vectors. You know, it's all digital, so just comes with different attack surfaces. The problem is that if you lose your coins or you do lose your validator, you don't have a good way of withdrawing your coins or recovering your losses. That is a bit of the risk with proof of stake. So I wouldn't say they're necessarily something that you can compare, because the end result of the consensus algorithm, the behavior it's trying to create and its mechanism design, is completely different. I do think Ethereum would not have been as successful if it had launched with proof of stake immediately from the get-go. It needed proof of work to distribute coins and enable people to join in the network and get engaged from day one with no friction. And that is the power of proof of work. Now that it's transformed into a purely dApp driven environment with, you know, lots of people using the platform as base level infrastructure, and since it's so dependent on more and more liquidity providers, now is the time to actually transition that over into a proof of stake model.
But is proof of stake on Ethereum specifically too exclusionary, as in terms of like how much you have to have in order to participate?
Yeah, it can be, and that's part of the mechanism it's trying to cater for. It's trying to tie up long-term investors that are not going to leave the network and are going to commit that stake for long periods of time. So it's not meant for your, you know, regular average user. That being said, your staking requirements are only 32 ETH right now. When that was initially put in place, it was only 4,000 plus worth of USD worth of Ethereum. Now it's quite a bit more. I'm not sure if the core devs have plans to adjust that or tune that. They might. But the idea is that only kind of your folks that actually have stake or interest in the network are going to run a validator and are going to be committed. If you're an average user, you can still engage in the Ethereum network. Nothing's stopping you there. Completely different mechanisms it's trying to cater for.
So I guess the last question I have is, there's obviously a lot of different proof of work opportunities out there for people, and proof of stake or staking in general. Like, there's a lot of exchanges that'll allow you to stake your coins and generate yield and things like that. But do you see people basically turning from Bitcoin or Ethereum, which are the, I guess, the most profitable in a lot of ways right now for mining? Do you see them going into Litecoin and these other things with the optional, you know, like dedicated ASICs for those? Seeing as there's less of a friction in terms of the supply and the demand and things like that?
I wouldn't say there's less of a friction. Altcoin ASICs are usually purpose-built. That's a weird way of saying it. Altcoin ASICs are usually, you get a run of an ASIC if you're interested in mining that specific altcoin, and that's it. Manufacturers usually won't produce more at the rate they do Bitcoin miners. Most of your medium-sized operations in the U.S. will have a really nice, diverse portfolio of Dogecoin miners, Litecoin miners, all sorts of different equipment, and then your hobbyist miners, of course. I do not think that businesses that are committed to Bitcoin and, you know, are really just focused on providing infrastructure to the Bitcoin network will dip into the altcoin space. And when it comes to the Ethereum miners, those are more likely to go into the altcoin space. Generally, Bitcoin miners are more loyal or committed to their chain, the larger ones at least, and they're kind of maximalists in their own right. Whereas you usually get your Ethereum miners that are more, I wouldn't say mercenary, because they're definitely, you know, still committed to the Ethereum chain. But once Ethereum does transition fully into the merge, these folks will, you know, spread off and diversify into other coins. And they'll be doing that on a purely, you know, profit decision basis. It won't be because they have necessarily any loyalty to specific chains.
Yeah, it seems like it's more of a obtaining as many dollars as you can mindset with a lot of the altcoin miners, right? So you're basically just looking to, you know, mine something, generate yield, sell it, you know, generate and go that way, which to like, I think you get into a high time preference, low time preference conversation with Bitcoin miners. And like you said, you're thinking 3 years, 5 years, 8 years ahead. because you're consistently rolling that capital into a bigger and bigger operation. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the altcoin people that I know, they're more likely to say that, yeah, well, I'm going to mine this and I'm going to flip it and get this instead. And, you know, they have a more transactional basis with each sort of batch, you know, that they're buying, whether it's equipment or, you know, whether it's the actual, like a DAO or whatever they're participating in.
Yeah. The interesting observation as well with smaller miners, altcoin miners, is they're often more loyal to many networks versus, you know, loyal to just one specific network. So you see them as, I like to call them kind of the difference between nomadic and tribalistic miners. Altcoin miners are very tribalistic. They will be loyal to, you know, their tribe or their tribes. They will still be trying to make a profit, but they'll usually stick around in the communities, help grow. They'll at least hold some of the coins so they can participate in the network. Whereas you usually have a subset of profit seekers, which are nomadic. These guys just jump from chain to chain. Amusingly, they're not always the GPU miners. Oftentimes they are some of the Bitcoin miners that are jumping and surfing from Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV to Bitcoin back when that used to be profitable. Or there'll be altcoin miners surfing between the various networks, which is why sharing your hash algorithm is bad, kids. So don't do that.
Well, Chrissy Lee, we thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us. We're certainly much smarter having listened to you, and we hope to have you on very soon in the future.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yeah, I've got a lot of research to do now, especially on the SHA spot. I think that sounds like it's got some promise.
Hey, thanks for joining the Bitcoin Bottom Line with Stephen McClurg and my co-host, CJ Wilson. See you next time.
The opinions presented herein are solely of the individual and are not necessarily representative of Valkyrie Investments, Inc. and their affiliates. There is no guarantee that any specific outcome will be achieved. Investments may be speculative, illiquid, and there is a risk of total loss of your investment. Past performance is not indicative of future results.